Welcome to The Weekly Listen, an Engelsberg Ideas podcast brought to you by the Axel and Margaret Axon Johnson Foundation and produced by Brooke Verlaget Stolper. The Weekly Listen features our essays, read by Leighton Pugh.
Religion and Politics in the Middle East, Per Stenbeck. Does religion influence politics more than politics influences religion in the Middle East? It may be impossible to offer a valid answer to this question. Perhaps the only lasting, albeit vague and unsatisfactory answer, is that politics and religion are irrevocably intertwined, and that the relationship between them varies from time to time and from country to country. Take a look at the world map, and you will find some of the countries most permeated by religious politics in the region of the Middle East. Take just three examples: the theocratic state of Iran, Saudi Arabia as the guardian of the holy places, and Israel, where the lines between its original state doctrine, politics, and religion have become blurred through the years since 1948. Lebanon is another example of a state where religious sectarianism forms the base for the political system, and where vague suppositions of the ratio between these sects create the ultimate key to decision-making and power-sharing. In Syria, a war is being waged between a secular regime with roots in an esoteric Islamic minority sect and a broad variety of more or less radical Islamic groups, some of them seeking to establish a caliphate. Turkey is, for the time being, ruled by a party gathering its strength from a revival of religious sentiment in a formerly secular state. In Egypt, the Muslim Brotherhood no doubt won a majority in democratic elections and is now paying the price for that victory at the hands of the military. All in all, Middle Eastern nations, rulers and people have never adopted the European and North American doctrine of separating church and state. Kemal Ataturk did so, but his legacy is fading. Some dictators with blood on their hands have seen a secular constitution as a way of neutralizing the religious and sectarian tensions between Sunni and Shia, or as a way of incorporating and securing the loyalty of religious minorities. But under attack, as in Iraq and Syria, they have lapsed back into a fabricated role as defenders of the one true faith. The Sunni-Shia struggle for religious and political dominance is the most important feature of the dynamics of the region. Here, once again, it is extremely difficult to draw a reliable picture. How much of this fierce struggle has purely religious motives? How much of it is mixed with or motivated by nationalism, history, and modern geopolitics? One thing is certain. Regardless of ancient prejudices, the crowds, tribes, and clans of the region are manipulated to believe in the perils, dangers, and murderous threats posed by followers of other groups. Through most of history, Shia and Sunni groups have lived largely at peace with one another. When the fabric and power structures of a society are torn apart, however, as happened when the US-led alliance overthrew Saddam Hussein, the floodgates open. One should also bear in mind the proportions. Only 10 to 15% of all Muslims are Shias, fewer than 200 million. Iran is the heartland of the Shia, Saudi Arabia the hardcore of the Sunni, and around this axis, many of the present conflicts in Syria and Iraq are playing out. The rebellion in Syria has been defined as a war being waged through proxies, a battleground for the main contenders, Iran and Saudi Arabia. True, the Assad regime receives unconditional support from Iran and its Lebanese client Hezbollah, but the opposition forces are divided into factions. Some of the jihadis are religiously motivated. Some may prefer a democratic and secular state. It has become a cliché to dismiss this division as a fatal weakness that can lead to victory for Assad. But it would be hypocrisy to expect unity and a common ideological denominator when fighting a dictatorship. In Iraq, the polarization between the Sunni minority and the government under Nouri al-Maliki has become a deadly threat to the stability and future of this post-war country. The Sunnis were politically marginalized when the scene became dominated by the Shia and the Kurds in the north. Maliki has succeeded in neutralizing the Sunni leadership and has promoted the perception that the Sunni quest for power sharing in Baghdad represents only a sectarian agenda. This led to a radicalization of Sunni groups, especially in the Sunni-populated governorates, principally in Nineveh and Kirkuk. Many Sunni Arabs came to the conclusion that they must engage in violence based on their confession, and the ground was ripe for the ISIS onslaught. Once again, sectarian belonging seems to have become the defining factor for the political future of a Middle East country. If one wishes to seek a parallel from history, the religious conflicts in Europe of the 30 Years' War comes to mind. At that time, two interpretations of true Christianity led to a devastating war to settle scores and draw new borders. Hopefully, this parallel would also mean that a type of Westphalian peace in the Middle East could rescue it from total chaos. Another parallel can be found in the small Gulf states of today and the small German states of that time, both ruled by kings of a different affiliation to that of large portions of their people. David Gardner in the Financial Times once defined Lebanon as a country saddled with a political class of warlords in suits, political entrepreneurs who treat their people not as citizens, but as cattle to be herded inside the country's 18 officially recognized sects. Instead of individual rights with guarantees of religious and political pluralism for each community, rights are vested in the sects in ways that their leaders, often scions of political dynasties, easily usurp and then trade with external powers seeking to bolster their interests in the region. Can such a state survive? So far, yes, thanks to a gifted and resourceful population, both inside and outside the country. The people of the huge Lebanese diaspora take a keen interest in their homeland and probably finance a great many political and religious activities within Lebanon. But the rise of Hezbollah has changed the playing field, and its involvement in Syria is drawing Lebanon into the battle zone, now stretching from Beirut to Baghdad. Caught between the Syrian war and a watchful Israel, the petty political games being played in Beirut are losing much of their innocence, and it remains to be seen whether enough cohesion can be found to save the state of Lebanon when the corpses and victims are counted. Anyway, it is doubtful if the sharing of the political spoils can continue much longer, with a Sunni prime minister, a Christian president, and a Shia speaker of the parliament. Lebanon has a long history of constructive interaction between its religious groups, which are many and colourful. To the surprise of many Europeans who are not so well versed in the history of the Middle East, Lebanon has, or more accurately had, a large Christian population. Christianity was once the leading religion, born in the region and dominant prior to the ascent of Islam, with only Judaism being older than the two other main religions. Turkey still had 2 million Christians in 1920. Today there are only a handful. Of Syria's population, one-third were Christians earlier in the 20th century. Today, less than 10%. In 1932, 55% of the Lebanese population belonged to one of the many Christian denominations. The Copts in Egypt prevail, forming perhaps 10% of the population, which means an impressive 8 to 10 million followers. Traveling by train from Cairo to Alexandria, the villages are dotted not only with minarets, but also with hundreds of churches. There are three reasons why the Christian minorities of most Middle East countries are diminishing in size and may become extinct if a reversal does not take place. Declining birth rates is one, though it is the least dramatic. In Israel, the rate is 32 live births per 1,000 Muslims and 22 among Christians. Persecution is the second reason, Christians being targeted in several countries. In Iraq, the once large Christian community became the scapegoat for the American-led invasion, and hundreds of thousands have since fled or emigrated. There were 300 churches before the invasion, today just 57. The number of Chaldo-Assyrian Christians fell from over 1 million to 150,000. Many of them are now in Sweden. The third reason is, of course, warfare. Patriarch Gregorius III of Antioch said in March that out of a population of 1.75 million, 450,000 Syrian Christians have fled their homes. They have suffered heavily from having been a minority protected by the Assad regime. It may be difficult for Western observers to accept, but minorities are at the mercy of the state and forced to seek protection, whoever the ruler is. The disappearance of these ancient religious minorities may be unavoidable because minorities have always suffered in times of war and crisis. In the Middle East situation, one can recognize the irony in what is happening. In several cases, it is interference by the West that has led to persecution and exodus. However, the West is doing very little or nothing to defend these minorities. Our secularized societies are almost ashamed to accept any responsibility for them. Perhaps some ill-informed decision-makers even believe they are remnants of colonialism or the Crusades. If we have problems sympathizing with our Christian cousins, it may be easier to look at their fate as a human rights issue, as a matter of the right to free expression of religious belief. According to Pew Research, restrictions on practicing religion, religious hostilities, and violence to enforce religious norms are all on the increase, and not just in the Middle East, but all around the world. More than 60% of the world population lives in countries that have government restrictions on practicing religion. However, as mentioned before, you find some of the most religion-permeated states in the Middle East. The most influential external power in the region, the United States, has, according to foreign policy research conducted in 2005, partly religious-based motives for its Middle East policies. The evangelical movement, the religious right in the US, has influenced decisions of the United States, especially those concerning Israel and the enemies of Israel. But when it comes to defending Christian minorities, the United States has been less effective than other powers, such as Saudi Arabia for Shias and Russia for Orthodox minorities. Let us finally turn to Israel and Palestine. Palestinians are sometimes seen as the most secularized Arabs, but also among them you can find religious fervor, mostly among followers of Hamas. In the last 7 years, during almost 30 missions to Israel and the West Bank, monitoring and negotiating implementation of humanitarian agreements, I have never met any religious arguments objecting to the need to accept common values. Of course, both sides usually refer to their respective fundamentalists when explaining limitations and mental barriers. No doubt Israeli domestic and foreign politics have strong components derived from the Jewish religion. The birth of the nation saw the influx of approximately 850,000 Jews expelled from Arab countries, which led to the near extinction of ancient Jewish minorities in the Middle East. 180,000 Jews left Egypt after 1948. This Israeli experience and the Zionist tradition still influence domestic policies. In his book, The Settlers, Gadi Taub describes the long struggle over the meaning of Zionism. He would like the reader to understand the irrepressible conflict between settlement of the West Bank and mainstream Zionism. Two brands of Zionism exist: secular Zionism, aimed at securing the future of Israel as a democratic state, and a religious Zionism that believes in expansion and annexation along biblical borders. These two ideologies permeate Israeli politics and form the fault line in the body politic. From time to time, we may think that one of these has won the upper hand and that the struggle is over, but their influence has shifted over time. The national religious segment is roughly 6-8% of the population, but its influence is much stronger. The unilateral withdrawal from Gaza in 2005 was a hard blow for the religious segment. Even with a strong Orthodox representation in the Knesset, some privileges for the religious are rolled back by the right-wing government. The future of the settlements remains undecided, and thereby the future of Israel itself, as the state its secular founders dreamed of. Nevertheless, without engaging the national religious parties in drawing up any peace treaty, the implementation of an accord is unlikely to succeed. The Israeli dilemma is a classic example of how a religious doctrine becomes a hurdle that casts a spell over the political arena and can shape the destiny of the nation. Religion is often ignored as a political factor. In the Middle East, this is not possible. Many ethnic groups are defined by their religion, and many policies can be explained by motives based on religious considerations. The rise of fundamentalism in the main religions represented in the region and the division of Islam into two warring sects are decisive factors for the future of the region and a major obstacle to modernization and reform. The relationship between politics and Islam seems to remain fundamentally different from that between politics and Christianity. In his book The Geopolitics of Emotion, 2008, Dominique Moïse writes that religion in the Middle East has become the main channel through which Muslims fight their feeling of humiliation, a humiliation that has many and deep roots. The glorious past has not been recreated, their leaders have failed, corruption prevails, and globalization has not brought them the progress they see in Asia or Europe. The Arab Spring changed very little. The intruder in the region, Israel, is still powerful. Arab and Islamic unity is but a dream, and foreigners continue to invade their lands. For Western liberal thinking, the trend towards intolerance in the Muslim world and the unsolved Palestinian issue create a moral challenge. For how long can we deal with states that deny their citizens full democratic rights, freedom of expression, and the right to choose and practice one's religion?
Thank you for listening to the Engelsberg Ideas Weekly Listen, read by Leighton Pugh. This podcast was brought to you by the Axel and Margaret Axon Johnson Foundation and produced by Buchverlaget Stolpe. For more writing from the world's leading thinkers on history and culture, featuring essays, historical portraits, and regular podcasts, visit engelsbergideas.com.